Electoral processes in the region were suspended and Kashmir came under the direct control of New Delhi. Also, the role of major pro-India political parties in Kashmir was belittled after New Delhi detained all pro-India politicians. The absence of people's political participation created a void in Kashmir's political sphere and raised many questions on New Delhi's claims of normalcy in the region. And to break the ice, amid tough security measures, New Delhi is holding local elections in 8 phases ending on December 19th. A large number of voters has braved cold weather to vote and each of them has their own reasons.
Our educated youth are doing menial jobs. We have problems like improper roads and lack of electricity. Who will take up our issues to higher-ups? That's why we voted for our trusted candidate.
Election boycott calls passed by the pro-independence camp of Kashmir were highly supported by the people of Kashmir. But this time they say they want to fight for equality and justice via elections.
We are seeking respect since we are treated as second-class citizens. The country's progress hardly reaches us. By casting our vote, we tell the champions of democracy to do justice. Earlier, our election boycott was an excuse for them. Now we will give them no excuse. We want equal rights and treatment.
While voters have their own reasons to cast ballots, candidates have their aims too.
I can't promise my people jobs and land rights because with Article 370 everything is gone. My goal is to safeguard my people against the plots of people with anti-Muslim agendas. I believe in peace and tranquility and I want to work for secularism in my block.
The main contesting parties in this local election are Bharatiya Janata Party, Indian National Congress and Alliance of Local Political Parties.
Amid heightened security, the elections in Indian-administered Kashmir are being portrayed by many as a step towards normalcy and peace in the region. However, experts say such electoral processes have hardly helped Kashmir in the past, adding long-lasting peace is only possible when the issue gets permanently resolved between India and Pakistan. Shahana Bhatt, Indian-administered Kashmir.
Despite the apparent demise of the Trump era, it is clear that the far-right movement in the West is still alive and well. White supremacy, racism and xenophobia are problems in every EU country.
But this is the end! It's the end! Enough's enough!
Coordinated by the European Commission Brussels, religious leaders from all of the main faiths have just taken part in a video conference.
Reports of anti-Semitic and anti-Muslim attacks are now almost part of everyday life in our beloved Europe.
The leaders say the answer is to show more unity and greater mutual respect.
I want to say that if somebody hurts a Muslim sister, a Jewish brother, they are hurting me.
The European Union's much-criticized asylum policy also came under the spotlight during the event.
Europe loses its soul if we continue to watch people drowning in the Mediterranean. That is why we support civil rescue missions.
Religious leaders insist the European Union must do more to ensure refugees play a positive and productive role in society. Experts agree.
There were mistakes in integration of the migrants and there were mistakes in education, or lack of education or lack of access to the educational system.
In the past, Saudi Arabia has been criticised for sponsoring terrorism in the EU. The European Commission says it is easier to brainwash vulnerable young men when they do not feel part of a community.
This sense of belonging would be the best shield against radicalisation, terrorism and hatred.
Work is continuing to try and curtail terrorist recruitment online in the EU. However, sociologists believe that is not the root cause of the security issue.
They say the source of the problem is not the internet, but the current climate within society. The focus should be on changing that, they argue. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
after a long hunger strike going beyond 100 days to protest against his detention. Without charge or trial, Palestinian prisoner Maher al-Akhras has been finally freed. The Israeli authorities released al-Akhras from the Israeli hospital of Qablan, where he was held for subsequent worsening of his health condition. He arrived at Al-Najah hospital in the West Bank city of Nablus following his release by Israeli authorities. After final medical examinations, he was moved to his hometown, Silat al-Dahr, north of the occupied West Bank. In a press statement, al-Akhras thanked the Palestinian people for the solidarity actions and insisted that gaining rights and liberty are only achieved through fighting.
Praise be to God that I am now among my family and my people in Nablus, and that, God willing, we will get rid of the occupation with the mighty wills of our people and live from victory to victory until we reach a greater victory and liberate Palestine.
Israel arrested al-Akhras in July over accusations of being a prominent member of the Jihad resistance group, which he denied. He immediately started his hunger strike, demanding that he should either be prosecuted for clear charges or be released. Israel at first refused to deal with his demands, but when he was at the verge of death, the Israeli High Court ruled that if al-Akhras ended his hunger strike, his administrative detention would not be renewed upon its expiration on 6th of November. Prominent figures who rushed to welcome al-Akhras praised his encouragement in what they described as defeating the occupation's authorities. Administrative detention involves no indictment, no revelation of confidential evidence, and no trial or judgment of the accusations against the prisoner. Hundreds of Palestinian prisoners are languishing in Israel's jails without charge or trial under the illegal so-called administrative detention. The inmates say their hunger strike is a bet to have their voice heard and to force the Israeli regime to end this illegal policy. Reports say more than 7,000 Palestinians are held in Israeli jails. Maher al-Akhras has achieved victory through his hunger strike, and he's free today. Experts say his battle definitely gives other Palestinian prisoners under administrative detention a glimmer of hope, enabling them to go on with their actions and their fight for justice that aim to get back their rights in Israeli jails. Mona Qandil, Occupied Ramallah.
The UN Conference on Trade and Development, UNCTAD, said in a report that Israel's prolonged blockade of the Gaza Strip and the regime's military operations against the Palestinian enclave had inflicted some $17 billion U.S. dollars in losses between 2007 and 2018. Richard Guzel-Wright, the director of UNCTAD's Globalization and Development Strategies, said that it was extremely difficult to see anything but redevelopment being the fate of Gaza society. The Israeli regime has placed the Gaza Strip under a tight blockade since 2007 and waged three wars on it since 2008. The blockade and military operations had driven the poverty rate in Gaza to increase almost fourfold compared with normal conditions.
The losses that were highlighted in the UNCTAD report show the extent of damage caused by the Israeli blockade and wars against the Gaza Strip, especially the three major wars since 2008. Israel has systematically destroyed civilian infrastructure and economic sectors, in addition to the loss of innocent lives.
According to the UNCTAD report, Gaza has witnessed one of the worst economic performances globally. In addition to killing and maiming thousands of Gazans during the wars, Israeli forces also bombed civilian infrastructure, as well as thousands of factories and businesses.
The Palestinian economy in Gaza is collapsing because of the Israeli wars and blockade. Israel waged three major wars in less than 10 years and destroyed all aspects of our economy in Gaza.
As day laborers, we sustained heavy losses because of the wars. Factories were destroyed during the wars, and thousands of people lost their sources of income.
UNCTAD says its estimates are partial because they cover only the economic cost of the Israeli occupation, from the prolonged closure and recurrent military operations in Gaza from 2007 to 2018. Experts say the Israeli regime must be held accountable for its illegal policies against the Palestinian people.
Israeli military aggressions and the blockade amount to war crimes, and the international community must bring an end to Israel's impunity. The Palestinian Authority and human rights organizations must also include the economic file in their complaints at the International Criminal Court because Israel perpetrated war crimes and crimes against humanity.
Observers say that for Gaza's economy to slightly recover, the blockade must be fully lifted.
According to UN figures, the Israeli regime is responsible for the near collapse of Gaza's regional economy and its isolation from the Palestinian economy and the rest of the world. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is part of a speech delivered on September 21st, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference with participants in ceremonies throughout the country to honor the veterans of the Sacred Defense Era. The meeting was held on the occasion of 40th anniversary of the Sacred Defense.
Basically, the front lines were a place where you could easily see sincerity and warmth. Everyone had a friendly relationship with others. In that arena, some people practiced sincerity and showed their divine intentions in action. We can also refer to their spiritual qualities, their midnight tears, their dawn prayers, their monotheistic enthusiasm and love, and their indifference to material trifles, and in certain cases, we witnessed their connection with Alamul Ghaib, the unseen world. Some of those dear ones and those mystic youth, mystic in the true sense of the word, had developed such spirituality in the front lines that they could see and predict the future. They could see their martyrdom, the martyrdom of their comrades, and the event that would happen. These points exist in soldiers' biographies, and they are really important.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want to need, my Lord. Protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
Of course, it is evident that the last point existed more than the others, thanks to Islam. Of course, prominence in other areas existed thanks to religious faith as well. But in particular, the last point originated from entrusting one's heart to God, to Islam, and to religious faith. One becomes really astonished at the effect of such deep faith. For example, martyrs' mothers had such deep faith. Well, you and I do not understand motherly affection at all. No one except for mothers themselves can really understand motherly feelings. However, these mothers sent their youth to the front lines. When their children went to them to ask for their permission, they responded, "Because you are going there for the sake of Islam, you may go." When they brought them the bodies of their youth, They expressed their joy at having offered them in the way of God.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to
Hi, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
Morning, sir.
Half a kilo of halim, please.
Hi, sir.
Hi, Kitty. Good morning.
Number one, hands up. Number two, hands on the waist.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Get ready for jogging to warm up.
Hello, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
One loaf of well-baked bread, please.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day He appointed for a rising. To Thee belongs praise, for Thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst Thou willed, Thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to Thee belongs praise, for Thou created, then proportioned, and ordained and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom.
I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure, and provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
The debate.
When it comes to the issue of human rights in Saudi Arabia, it's a well-known fact that there is minimal existence of this in the kingdom. Opposition is not only condemned, but could consist of jail time. The regime is back in the spotlight, with the continued detention of at least five women's rights activists. In this edition of the debate, we will look at the abysmal human rights record in Saudi Arabia, and how member countries of the so-called international community continue their dealings with Saudi Arabia, one of their initiatives being economic gains.
Seven out of the nine European countries which have appointed human rights ambassadors have criticized the continued detention of women's rights activists in Saudi Arabia. In a statement, the ambassadors of the UK, the Netherlands, Germany, Sweden, Estonia, Luxembourg and Finland call for the release of all political detainees in Saudi Arabia.
We remain deeply concerned by the continued detention of at least five women's rights activists in Saudi Arabia. Peaceful activism and advocating for women's rights is not a crime. We join the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, special rapporteurs and treaty bodies in reiterating our call for the release of all political detainees, including women's rights activists.
The envoy specially drew attention to the cases of two activists, Lujain Al-Hathloul and Samar Badawi. Hathloul was put on trial last Wednesday after 900 days in prison, but her case was transferred to the Specialized Criminal Court. That's the institution that Amnesty International says is used to, quote, silence dissent. She is charged with attempting to destabilize the kingdom for defying Riyadh's ban on women's driving 1 month before it was officially lifted in June 2018. The case of Badawi, who had also campaigned against a driving ban, was earlier sent to the same court. Along with the European Human Rights Envoys, Chairman of the US House Intelligence Committee Adam Schiff has also called for the immediate release of the activists. But both the Europeans and the US have so far only paid lip service to the Saudi suppression of dissent and other gross human rights violations. Saudis have a long list of violations of human rights. They have led a deadly crackdown on a decade-long uprising in the oil-rich and Shia-majority eastern province, especially in Qatif region, where protesters seek an end to discrimination and political marginalization. That's beside what Human Rights Watch calls infringement on freedom of expression, association and belief, as well as migrant workers' rights. Riyadh has also helped Bahrain quash the 2011 uprising for democracy, supported an armed Takfiri terrorist in Syria, and has been leading a bloody war of aggression on Yemen, which has killed tens of thousands of Yemenis, mostly women and children. But silence has been Western countries' reaction to Riyadh's role in Bahrain and Syria. And in Yemen, the West has encouraged and supported the Saudis by continuing to sell the kingdom the arms it uses to kill civilians. These are besides sweeping the Jamal Khashoggi case under the rug after the US Central Intelligence and the UN clearly linked his murder to Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Riyadh appears to have carte blanche on abusing human rights, which limits Western reactions to his crimes to occasionally strongly worded statements. Actions, however, remain lacking thanks to Europeans and the US's lucrative trade deals with Saudi Arabia.
Joining us for this edition of The Debate, journalist and author Daniel Lazar joins us from New York. We have author and academic Lawrence Davidson joining us from Westchester. I'd like to welcome you both. Lawrence Davidson, I'm going to first start with you and just pretty much ask you a very, very simple question. Saudi Arabia, human rights, what comes to your mind immediately?
Well, what comes to my mind is a dictatorship that uses religion as a cover, and the economic resources it has to essentially buy the silence of everybody else. There's other things that are going on here. And it's not only the economic deals that you've mentioned in the introduction. There is there's a reluctance on the part of the international community, which is a nation-based community, to seriously interfere in what they consider to be the internal affairs of other countries. And this is an age-old principle. It started to break down after the Second World War, and the example we got with the Holocaust and the Stalinist concentration camps that he ran in the West, and so that started to deteriorate. But now it's back. So the reluctance to have anyone interfere in another country's what is considered their internal affairs is something that holds back these countries from going beyond strong statements. And it's also what underlies vetoes, often vetoes in the Security Council and that sort of thing. So it's got a history to it.
Okay, the reason why we have this topic for this debate, Daniel Lazar, is the case of five women, which has been highlighted, especially with these five European countries, for example, who are deeply concerned about their detention, because right now they've been referred to the Special Criminal Court for terrorism and national security. One of them is this lady by the name of Hathloui, who was targeted because of a law barring women from driving, which later, obviously, that law was annulled. So tell us what you think that somebody was detained for that is now in a court, a special criminal court for terrorism and national security.
Well, I mean, Saudi Arabia is quite simply the most undemocratic country on the face of the earth, and that includes us, North Korea, other terrifying dictatorships, but Saudi Arabia is in a class by itself. First of all, the country is wholly owned by the Al Saud, the House of Saud. It's really their private property. They treat it as their private property. They monopolize political power, and they simply do not grant the slightest rights to other people who live there. In the case of this woman who was arrested, it's a classic example of what happened in Saudi Arabia. Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince, knew he had to loosen the regulations on banning women from driving for purely international reasons. He did so, but at the same time, he clamped down on women agitating for that right from within, because he can't tolerate any kind of challenge to his authority, no matter how mild, no matter how circumspect, even if he agrees with what the challengers are calling for. So it's a total dictatorship, a total crackdown, and one which allows for absolutely no free expression by individuals outside the royal family. And even within the royal family, I might add, there's a reign of terror that prevents any kind of criticism of Mohammed bin Salman or his father, King Salman.
Well, Lawrence Davidson, you mentioned the economic gains here. I'm looking at the fact that you have these five European countries that have come out and made these statements. But what is the checklist when it comes to dealing with Saudi Arabia? I mean, when these countries like the U.S., like the U.K. or France, take a look at this checklist when it comes to the issue of human rights, well, they're going to go down and see, well, you know, people are being put in jail, there's sham trials, and there's a war that they're killing people in Yemen, for example, and yet they're dealing with them. They're dealing with the Saudi regime, going to the G20, giving them, again, another stamp of approval, of acceptance in the business community, per se. So that kind of sounds like double standards when it comes to the so-called international community.
Oh, absolutely. And if you're looking for morality in international affairs, it's not there in any driving or practical way. After the Second World War, lip service was paid. It was thought required to be paid to human rights because of the horrors of the Holocaust and other genocides that were coming down the line and all this sort of thing. So you had the international community, particularly Western countries, taking a verbal stand against that. But when it comes to diplomatic relations, when it comes to economic profit, all of these countries, one way or another, they have internal important companies that are making money off of Saudi Arabia, and so they feel that they have to maintain that double standard. And again, it's the history of international relations that in fact you do not bring morality into it in any serious way. Here in the United States, there's been a long-standing debate between idealists and realists. Realists are those who, you know, want to dispense with morality when it comes to international relations, and they generally have won the argument. It's not a surprise. And I don't think it's going to change under Biden, certainly. And this is the way it is until we can resurrect some sort of, you know, morality, standards of morality for international relationships. International law seems presently dead in the water.
Well, there was almost a total embrace when it came to Mohammed bin Salman, the Crown Prince Daniel Lazar, when he introduced his reform agenda. I mean, you have headlines like the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, power behind the throne. And then there was a shakedown that happens where you had all these wealthy businessmen, some of them princes, at the Ritz-Carlton, alongside people being jailed. And then you had the assassination of Khashoggi, which was in the worst way with the dismemberment, etc. So what happened to the reform agenda? I mean, when we talk about the way that Saudi Arabia is still being embraced, whilst it has committed these atrocious crimes that are in the human rights arena, it's basically giving it a stamp of approval to continue dealing with it.
Yes, yeah, so you've got to bear in mind that that not only is the is Saudi Arabia the most undemocratic country on the face of the earth, it's also the sick man of the Middle East. Its political institutions are in disarray. Its economy is a wreck thanks to the fall in oil prices. MBS's attempts to diversify the economy have gone nowhere. And the reign of terror that MBS is conducting will eventually backfire and will eventually lead to his own doing. He's a dictator isolated in his palace. He's surrounded by enemies on all sides. It's only a matter of time before he falls. And if he falls, there will be chaos. So that's what the Western countries, the so-called Western democracies, are trying to prevent. They're trying to uphold the Saudi regime by all means possible. And so if Mohammed bin Salman makes some kind of gesture towards reform, the U.S., Britain, France, etc., all cheer wildly, all in the hope that there's somehow this story will have a happy ending. But it won't. The regime can only crash and burn. It's profoundly unstable. Its days are numbered. We don't know how long it'll last. It could be days, could be years, could conceivably be even longer. But the handwriting is on the wall. This is a regime slated for self-destruction.
Well, let's talk a little bit, Lawrence Davidson, about an issue that many are not aware of. And that is the suppression that happens in the eastern Qatif region where the Shia minority actually live. And we need to talk about that because these people are being suppressed. And also at the same time, we can compare that, the suppression, to what's happening to the Shias in Bahrain. So here you have these two brothers, namely Bahrain and Saudi Arabia, suppressing the Shia population in their countries. What's your take on that?
Well, these particular dictators, both in Bahrain and Saudi Arabia, have been raised within this Sunni Muslim sect to see Shiites as dangerous, as heretics. And this sort of thing, and now, and in Saudi Arabia, you've got this sort of weird kind of situation, where it's Shiites who work in the oil fields in the east, and so they're constantly under observation and suspect. So essentially, because the Sunni rulers expect or see the Shiites as dangerous and heretical, they expect an uprising, and so they suppress them and create the conditions for an uprising. It doesn't, it's not an indication that these guys are thinking things through, but it's an ideologically driven kind of hatred that they have. And so it's not surprising that the suppression of the Shiites in Saudi Arabia is a long-standing. It's not new. And periodically, the Shiites react in stronger ways or less stronger ways, but it's ongoing. And it's certainly not surprising that the Saudis intervened to support the Sunni minority regime in Bahrain. So... in both cases, they saw it in their international. They see this in terms of their internal interests to maintain their own dictatorship.
Daniel Azar, another thing that Saudi Arabia has been really critiqued for is this Sharia law, but not that the way that Sharia is practiced. Not that Sharia in Muslim countries that practice it is something that's bad, but because a distorted version of it has been adopted by one of the worst entities that actually spelled danger for much of the world, and that was for the Daesh terrorists, who adopted this type of ideology in their own warped way. And many said that perhaps that emanated from Saudi Arabia. Do you see that Saudi Arabia is guilty somewhat of that?
Oh, of course. I mean, listen, since 1979, the takeover of the Grand Mosque in Mecca, the Saudi royal family has been determined to burnish its credentials, its Islamic credentials, by exporting its own brand of Islam, which is a brand known as Wahhabism, which is extremely harsh, extremely intolerant, and which enforces a very unforgiving form of Sharia. So what we've seen throughout the Sunni world since 1979 has been the Wahhabization of the Sunni world. This is evident from Indonesia to the suburbs of Paris. And this has had a dramatic effect, and it's wreaked havoc both within the global Muslim community and also in terms of that community's relations with the outside world. It's promoted a very xenophobic, inward-looking, anti-modernist point of view, which has been disastrous for Muslims first and foremost. And of course, it's also driven the conflict with Iran. Bear in mind, anti-Shiism is goes to the heart of the Saudi regime. In 1803, I believe it was, the al-Saud launched an attack on, I believe it was Karbala, in which thousands of Shiites were killed. And so this strain of belief goes way back as far as the regime is concerned. And so the al-Saud, the royal family, has placed itself at the disposal of the United States, which has used them as kind of their Praetorian guard to police the Middle East and impose a kind of a Wahhabist conformity throughout the Middle East in order to marshal opposition to Iran and its allies.
And finally, my question to you, Lawrence Davidson, you said that the incoming administration, if confirmed, once confirmed in the U.S., is going to carry on as business as usual. Why do you say that? You don't think there will be a change in the way that it approaches Saudi Arabia, especially when it comes to things like the war in Yemen?
Yeah, well, my position on this is that economic relations with Saudi Arabia will continue as usual. It's much too lucrative for the economy, U.S. economy, which isn't in very good shape, to not do that. So Biden will continue his relationship with Saudi Arabia, particularly in terms of economics. Now, with a proper amount of pushing on the part of the more progressive elements, and maybe some of the people that he's actually bringing into the State Department and the NSA and what have you, we might be able to push him to withdraw U.S. support, active support, for the war in Yemen. There might be still U.S. naval ships in the area that help it in the blockade and what have you. It's likely that we can encourage Biden to remove that kind of support for the Saudi war in Yemen, but there will be no breakage of economic or diplomatic relations and this sort of thing, unless the Saudi prince oversteps his bounds. The killing of the journalist, which happened in another country, albeit in a Saudi embassy, but still, it happened in another country, in Turkey, and Khashoggi was an American, had an American green card, and so that kind of behavior comes very close to overstepping the bounds and requiring some sort of reaction. Now he got away with that, at least with the Americans this time. If he tries that again, or if there's repeated examples of that, then he's going to get into trouble in the international environment.
Okay, thank you very much. Well, unfortunately, I have to end it. We're fresh out of time. Journalist and author Daniel Lazar, thank you for your comments, and author and academic Lawrence Davidson there with his comments. Thanks for tuning in to another edition of The Debate. From Mikhail Vitalov, the entire team, it's goodbye. Until next time.
This is IRIB English Radio. Website is www.parstoday.com/en.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, as a reminder, we discussed Imam Khomeini's style of teaching in brief. We said that he was very humble in hearing to the criticism of his students and also encouraged them to have a critical spirit rather than accepting what is taught very easily. However, he would never let anyone waste the time of the class for trivial and lengthy debates. It is vital for teaching to have three features to be effective. First, teaching should be based on a specific aim. The teacher should know what he is seeking and where he wants to reach. Secondly, there should be a reciprocal relation between the teacher and the student. Unilateral teaching and monologue is rarely effective and fruitful. The student should be involved in the course of teaching. Thirdly, the teacher should provide easy and suitable opportunities for learning to enable the student to learn the material in the easiest way. Experts of education have divided teaching's techniques into four categories. The first technique is teaching based on direct conveying of information. The second technique is based on interaction and involvement. The third one is problem-oriented, and the fourth one is individual teaching. Although it is not simple to refer one of these techniques over others, experts maintain that the interactive technique is the best and most successful method. The interactive technique is characterized by active teaching. In this method, the activity of the learner or student is highly emphasized. This is why it is also called active method technique. In other words, the student has a very active role in class. He or she participates in discussions and raises his or her view on various issues, trying to solve problems. He or she gathers experiences from the teacher and is guided by the teacher. The teacher does not behave as a superior authority, but as a guide and director. This method leads to thriving of creativity and talents of students rather than bringing up lethargic and passive students. Imam Khomeini's method of teaching was very active and discussion-oriented. Late Ayatollah Muhammad Hadi Ma'rifat said, "When the Imam raised an issue for discussion, both Arab and non-Arab ulema would come. Imam Khomeini would let them debate. Some would say that he hadn't had this method in Qom and had started it in Najaf. He would allow debates in public sessions. Sometimes the Imam himself would participate in the discussion so that even students like me could debate with him. But if there was a debate among friends, he would keep silent and listen unless when his opinion was asked. Then he would participate in the debate. His method was quite honorable and vital for us." Dear listeners, one of the factors that make classes non-interactive is the scientific vanity of the teacher. Scientific vanity prevents active participation of students in scientific debates and blocks the way of progress. According to all of his classmates and students, Imam Khomeini was devoid of any scientific vanity, and this had made his classes the most active classes among seminaries. Ayatollah Qadiri says, "The Imam would show no negative reaction to good words. He was never seen to have scientific vanity towards his knowledge. He would say, 'Maybe this is correct, maybe that is correct.'" Late Ayatollah Abdul Karim Musavi Ardabili said, "Imam Khomeini never had scientific vanity. In his books, he would not use phrases or words to denote that he had plunged in scientific vanity to have the connotation that nobody could understand as much as he could." Dear friends, Imam Khomeini was a good listener to the audience of his words, especially those who would object his words and writings. Late Ayatollah Abbas Ali Zanjani said, "Anyone who talked at the Imam's class, even the young students who were raising an objection, the Imam would give them opportunity and would listen to them. This would train the students in this way. I have seen this characteristic in Imam Khomeini's class and even his ordinary dealings. When someone wanted to tell him something, he would listen to him exactly and with full attention." Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, used to teach in a way to bring up his students self-confident. Ayatollah Mazahiri says, "The Prophet of Islam would behave with his companions in a way that each of them thought that he was the dearest for him. Imam Khomeini was like this in his teaching. He would regard his students with high esteem so that their talents would flourish. He would accept a good word and thank for it." Ayatollah Muwahhidi Kermani says, "Imam Khomeini taught in Masjid al-Azam, that is the great mosque in Qom. At the end of the class, he would sit for a while and people would gather around him. I raised the objection that I had in my mind. The imam was silent for a short while. Then he said, I have to think. This is very humble. In these cases, professors usually give an answer immediately so that their scientific status is not hurt before the student. But the imam showed humbleness and said, I have to think. Dear listeners, next time we will continue this discussion.
Of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Thank you. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.